So here you are. Now we can call you, instead of Roy Blunt humorist, I guess we can call you Roy Blunt novelist now, huh?
That's right, which elevates me, at least in my own eyes, considerably. I mean, it's hard going around being a humorist. You talk to someone on the plane, and they ask you what you do, and you say you're a writer. And they say, what do you write? And you have to say, well, humor and funny things. And there's no more lugubrious topic than exactly what kind of humorous things, and I don't like to start quoting them. So it's much better, I think, to be able to say quite cheerfully that I am a novelist, and I've written a novel about a woman who becomes the first woman president of the United States, which drags her husband into the unenviable position of being the first male first lady.
Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. When somebody asks you what you do and you say, I'm a writer, I write humor, do they ever say, well, you're not so funny?
Well, they never quite say that, but certainly that hovers in the air, because I've always felt that my narrator in this book is, in fact, a humorist, and he mentions that people are always expecting him to say something funny, and he says, do people, when they meet Kim Basinger, expect her to get naked? I mean, just because she does that for a living doesn't mean she's going to do it. In fact, they don't expect her to, probably don't even hold out much hope that they will, but somehow people seem to think that humorists will say something funny, but in fact, saying something funny is sort of like getting naked. You don't want to do it except when you feel like it.
Well, I bump into neighbors in my apartment house. Sometimes they say, hey, what's been happening today? What kind of news? And
yeah.
I said, well, I'm paid to report the news. I'm not going to do it on my off time. So I guess a humorist doesn't have to be funny on his off time.
No, if I'm getting paid, I will sort of summon up the proper frame of mind. But I need to have a great deal of downtime. I think humorists tend to be notoriously gloomy sorts, in fact. I think that being funny is a sort of way of working your way out of being gloomy. And I think anybody who knows anything about humorists down through the years, or even who knows anything about, people, will not expect humorists to be funny just constantly. I mean, there's nothing more horrible than somebody who's sort of addicted to being funny, who's always on and always forcing it and always trying to be funny. I certainly dread ever getting to that point, because I've always wanted just to make as much sense as possible, not to be as funny as possible. But being funny to me is a way of making sense, and a way of saying things that I don't know how to, that, seem to me can be said better funny.
Well, Roy, now that you're a novelist, that means you're going to be hanging around with people like Bello and Mailer and the gang, huh?
Well, they're a little old for me. I think I'll run with a little faster crowd. I mean, they used to be pretty fast, but I don't know. Maybe they have a better time than they seem to. I don't want to go to a lot of parties populated by rich people in fancy dresses. That's too much like being first lady.
Well, you've written, about a dozen books or so, right? This is your first novel. But you made efforts before.
Yeah, I have. This is my 10th book and first novel, and I've probably a little long in the tooth to be a first novelist, but I've started a number of novels. I always thought it would be a great thing to write one. And I think I started my first one when I was in college, and I wrote about 2 pages. And I've always, ever since then, had a kind of novel working in my head, actually. So one novel or another that I thought might come together, and none of them ever really achieved critical mass in my head. I did go so far as to write 30 pages once of a novel. But I didn't feel that I knew what I was doing, and I sort of let it go and set it aside. I was looking at it recently, and I thought I might pick it back up again now that I am a novelist. But in this case, I took an advance. I mean, I am a writer I've been a professional writer ever since I was in high school, actually, and I find that having taken an advance and spent the money is a great inducement to go ahead and do the work. So that helped me push my way through my lack of faith in myself as a novelist. I mean, I had to do it. I was more afraid not to do it than I was to do it. It was a really scary thing, though, making up all these people and making up settings and presuming. I always assume that novelists knew more about how the world operates than I do. But I can see now that you can kind of fake it. You know, it was a desperate kind of struggle to sort of patch together some kind of world, you know, a whole world. And I feel now that I've done it once, I think I can do it some more times. But it was took a real leap of faith.
Well, what you're saying is echoed by almost everybody. I do two or three interviews with authors, mostly fiction writers, a week. And almost all of them say writing fiction is a terrifying prospect. It's something they have to do. I think it's in their genes or something. It's something they have to do, but it is very, very difficult. And some of them say they just despise it, but they still have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was, it made me feel extremely excited and, but sort of frightened at the same time. I mean, writing about intimate things between man and wife is an embarrassing thing to do. I mean, but it was, you know, I have all sorts of things built up in my head from various relationships that didn't work out. Everybody wants to try to understand. I assume everybody wants to try to understand what went wrong in previous relationships. So it was finally interesting to sort of try to dramatize all that, and in the process I changed it all around. And another thing I've realized is that people who ask, I can understand now why novelists get so irritated by being asked how autobiographical a book is, because I had to make it up. I mean, I didn't remember. I don't remember my life well enough to have written it the way it happened, Nobody remembers the way it happened anyway. But so you have to cobble together all kinds of things from things that are sort of like things you did do and things that other people have told you about and try to, because you can't capture yourself and other, or at least I can't imagine capturing myself or other people I've known well on paper. I mean, there are two characters of the narrator. My book has two children, and I have two children, and I use a lot of my feelings for my children in making up those children, but they're certainly not my children. They're different people, and my children can tell that. But
you don't live in a vacuum, so you have to draw on your observations. That doesn't have to be, as you say, autobiographical, but you do have to draw on at least observations and things that you know.
Sure.
How else could you possibly write anything if you didn't use your experiences?
Yeah, but I mean, you sort of use them, but it's like using your experiences as sort of scraps of experiences along with scraps of things that other people have told you, and along with scraps that you've torn out of the newspaper, and sort of running it all together to make something coherent. Otherwise, so to make something that seems sort of seems like a real story, but the only way to tell something that seems like a real story is to make it up. A lot of the things that seem to me to ring truest, so far as I can tell myself, I've just made up. It just popped out of my head. So I found that exciting but a little eerie.
Well, let's talk about First Hubby, a book. I was interrupted at least once when I was hit on the head by a fish while reading this book, but that was obviously a fluke.
I hope that doesn't happen.
I'm shameless as in terms of stealing from other people's material.
What
gave you the idea to set this book in Washington and have a first husband?
Well, I've always wanted, as I said, to write a novel, and I was reading a review of a novel by D.M. Thomas called Summit, which came out a couple of years ago. And it was some kind of political novel. I never read the book, but it had to do with the summit conference between Bush and Gorbachev, I guess, or Reagan. At any rate, it was a political satire. And I thought, well, you know, I could write something like that, a kind of political satire. And I started thinking what sort of political satire I would write. And I happened to be reading a column by William Safire in the New York Times, and he used the term first hubby to refer to, in fact, Ronald Reagan, oddly enough. But I mean, talking about the influence, the power of Nancy Reagan, and sort of dismissively referred to Reagan as first hubby. And so that sort of mixed into my thinking, and then I thought it would be interesting to put myself in the place of the sort of the wife role, because I think any man who's been married or involved with a woman during this the last 20 years of transition in roles has had arguments about, you know, the trap that wives find themselves in. I mean, I've had, you know, wives have been known to complain that they don't want to have to live where the couple is living. I mean, why should we have to live here just because your job is here? You know, that sort of thing. So I put myself in the position of the person who doesn't want to live somewhere just because his spouse's job is there. He doesn't want to be in the White House. So all those things. So, and I thought it'd be interesting to take a position that was opposite. I mean, opposite from the position I'd had in real life, and to explore it and try to be, you know, try to expand my sympathy for traditional female roles by putting myself in one, or somebody sort of like me.
Now, how does Fox? What's his first name?
Guy Fawkes.
How does Guy's life change after he moves into the White House, and what about his relationship with his wife?
Well, of course, he hasn't been famous before. All of a sudden, he has been a humorist, but he's been writing about life in the country, and his wife has already been a sort of media figure, but in a kind of marginal way. I mean, she's not been a professional politician, so he hasn't really had to be a politician's spouse. And all of a sudden, he's a spouse. That's his job. He's famous for being a spouse. And he has this, he supposedly, and the first lady has to do all these dumb things like answer letters from school children and host White House teas. And they ask Guy Fawkes how he wants to redecorate the White House. And he doesn't want to redecorate the White House. It looks fine to him. You know, he hates redecoration. He doesn't want to deal with that. And he disappoints all these people. You know, the First Lady has an enormous staff, secretaries who have secretaries, and they all are waiting for him to be a First Lady and do the sort of things First Ladies have always done. And he doesn't want to do them. He doesn't know how to do them, and he feels silly doing them. Somebody, in one of the reviews of this book, raised the question of whether I was making sport of the very notion of a woman president. And I certainly didn't mean to be doing that. I think what I was making sport of was the very notion of a male first lady, which seems to me to sort of bring out the differences between men and women, and also the, you've had movies like Kramer versus Kramer, where a man had to be a mom, in effect, and had to make breakfast for his child, and this immensely sympathetic father who had to try to maintain his job and also play the female role for his little child. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to just sort of put a man in a position that's traditionally been a female position and have him just louse it up and not be good at it, which seems to me quite possible.
Well, how could he louse it up too much? He's got a press secretary.
That's right. Well, he hires a press secretary.
Who's a very candid press secretary.
That's right. He talks about what's wrong with Washington. And, of course, you have to know that my president and her husband are put into the White House by a series of unlikely events. So there's been a coup. I mean, one reason I wanted to write this book was to get the Republicans out of the White House. I'm afraid. I have this sense that, you know, you remember when Reagan was, people were talking about Reagan's involvement in the Iran-Contra mess. People were saying, well, we can't really impeach Reagan because all we would get would be Bush. And then now Bush is in the office and everybody's saying, well, Let's hope nothing ever happens to Bush, because that would give us Quayle. Now, when Quayle gets to be president, who's going to be his vice president? Who's going to be, it must be, I don't know, Jesse Helms. People will be saying, well, we can't get rid of Dan Quayle. We'll just get Jesse Helms. And within about 24 years, I figure the vice president will be a parakeet. You know, there's just going to be this terrible regression, and I wanted to save the country from that. So I tried to think of a way to put the Democrats in the White House, but, you know, I just couldn't do it. I mean, any more than anybody else can. So I have this third party. So I have both of the major parties self-destruct.
And now we have Marilyn Quayle leading the coup.
That's right. Marilyn, it all has to do with, the Bush administration is disgraced by the machinations of Marilyn Quayle, who senses that her husband is not going to be included on the ticket in 1992, and therefore she first tries to seduce George Bush and then tries to poison him, and then she is caught and escapes to Libya. So while all this is going on, Marilyn Quayle is in exile in Libya, and so all that makes everything sort of strange. I wanted to get to break this terrible succession of Republicans, and I also wanted to imagine a president I liked. You know, there hasn't been one. I don't think there's ever been one that, I mean, I guess Jack Kennedy you could like, but now in retrospect, he was sort of dubious. But
so you didn't like Carter?
I was very ambivalent about Carter. I defended Carter because I thought that everybody built him up to be something greater than he was, and then suddenly turned their backs on him and said that, you know, dismissed him too hastily. And I thought there was an element of anti-Southern bigotry there.
But I thought your book, Crackers, was an homage to Carter.
No, I think somebody, one of the reviewers compared it to Portnoy's Complaint as a saga of ethnic ambivalence. But, I got behind Carter at first because everybody else seemed to love him, and it seemed to, I remember my ex-brother-in-law, Gerald, there was the Carter nominating convention, and there was Daddy King, Martin Luther King Sr., leading the nation and singing "We Shall Overcome" in support of this white Georgian, and it made me feel good. And my ex-brother-in-law jumped up, who's from the South too, jumped up and said, "We ain't trash no more." So I did have that rooting interest in Carter, but I never thought of him as a great president. So I tried to make Clementine Fox, the president in my book, a really likable and engaging president. But a problem with that is that, like Jack Kennedy before her, she sort of uses her sex appeal as in her appeal to the nation, and that makes her husband jealous. I mean, he's jealous of the whole country. And one of their old friends tells him that you have to realize that the whole country is in love with your wife, and therefore they want you to be dead. And that's sort of awkward for him. But he tries to bear up and tries to be supportive, you know, and he wants to be what he's supposed to be for her sake, but he just can't bring himself to do it. So a great deal of the book is about, then there are flashbacks to how they met and how they fell in love and how they broke up once and how they came back together, which involved the Ku Klux Klan and all sorts of things, a shooting and all sorts of things. But so the book is largely about a story about their marriage and about their love.
And how does Guy Fawkes reconcile some of these problems during his wife's tenure?
Well, all sorts of things happen, and he finally, at the end, I don't want to give away everything that happens, but they come to a kind of limited, you know, he becomes a little more political. He learns to sort of wheel and deal and compromise within the marriage. And so there's a political story working, and there's also a personal story working at the same time. And the two are sort of tied up together at the end, but it's not tied up so neatly that you assume that things are going to run smoothly forever.
Well, what about bringing Marilyn Quayle back from exile?
Well, that's a big part of the plot, and I won't say what happens exactly, but we're all waiting for Marilyn to come back because while Guy, the narrator, and the first hubby is trying to save his marriage, his wife is trying to hold her, you know, he's trying to hold on to their feeling for each other, and meanwhile she's trying to hold on to her feeling for the country, and the country's feeling for her, and she needs a triumph, you know. And he meanwhile Noriega has beaten his drug rap and has gone back to Panama and taken over again, and so she's tempted to go down. She needs a success, you know, like Bush needed a success, so he went down and knocked off Panama. So she's considering knocking off Noriega again, and he gets really unsupportive about that, and says, in fact, one of Guy Fawkes' weaknesses is that he likes to make puns, and he says, when she says she's considering reinvading Panama, he says sarcastically, go ahead, have yourself a merry little isthmus, and that really tears it. She finds that extremely unsupportive, and there's lots of tension between them after that. So he's trying to ease that tension, and meanwhile grumbling to himself about why he has to ease the tension, why can't she ease the tension? I mean, and there's a scene where they all they come together in a remarkable way.
Very, very funny book, Roy. You had a one-man show a while back, didn't you?
I did, at the American Place Theater in New York. I talked for an hour and a half.
That must have been terrifying.
No, I find writing much more terrifying than speaking, because you get up, most writers don't like to stand before an audience and talk. I don't know why I do. Probably something wrong with me. But I do like, I find it much, you know, you have to say something, so you just say something. Whereas if you're writing, you go over and over and over it and try to make it perfect, and you worry about whether it is perfect, and you don't have anybody responding to it, so you don't, you think that's pretty good, and then you think, well, is it pretty good? And you turn the sentence back around another way, and you, and it's for me at least, there's enormous anxiety in writing, because you have to make it perfect. You have to write it on the page. I mean, don't ever make it perfect, but you have to, ideally, and I expect myself to somehow put it on the page so it's just, so that it's independent of me, and it can speak for itself, you know, and that's a daunting task. And but when you're talking for an audience, you can wave your arms and jump up and down and throw your hat in the air and do things that you can't get away with in writing. You can also, when you do an hour and a half show, you can say pretty much the same thing night after night. I mean, you can get...
So you went in prepared. You knew...
Yeah, what? I mean, I never did write... That show was all sort of improvised in that I never wrote any of it down. I've since written some of the material that I generated for that show.
What was the thrust of your comments?
Well... I started out talking. I did it differently every night, but there were three long stories that were my main stories, and I weaved those stories around each other. And is it weaved or wove? That's another thing that you can do when you're writing. When you're talking, you can just admit to your ignorance, but when you're writing, you have to get it right. At any rate, I weft those. Those three stories together, and in different ways, it sort of combined and recombined those stories so that every time it had a sort of different point. But there's a long story about it. It was a long, shaggy dog evening is what it was.
I don't know. I'm a terrible speaker myself, and I tend to want to write everything down for fear of making a fool out of myself. But some people are wonderful. Louis Grizzard is terrific, too, but he charges something like $20,000 an appearance.
Well, according to the New York Times Magazine, that's true, yeah. Well, I don't charge that much. I mean, if I could, I would.
you had a fairly regular gig on the CBS Morning News, didn't you? Are you still doing that?
I did that for a while. No, back a couple of years ago when it was the CBS Morning program, I did it. Every Monday I would come on and talk for 10 minutes, I think it was, and at a certain hour in the morning. And it was the only regular job. I mean, it wasn't a job, but I would just do it once a week. But it's the most regular thing I've done for a long time, but I'm probably not meant for regular things, because I did it for a while, and then there was a strike, the writer's strike, you know, and I, even though I was, that show was in the entertainment division, I don't know, I decided I didn't want to cross the picket line, so I didn't go in. And then the strike lasted for a long time, and by the time when the strike was over, they informed me I had been canceled.
You still see Garrison Keillor?
Yeah, we're good friends, and I mean, there's certainly somebody. I guess that writers are more likely to be talkers now in this audiovisual age. Certainly, Garrison is a great talker, and but there have been, you know, Dickens loved to stand before an audience and talk, and Mark Twain, and so there's some precedent for writers being public speakers as well. And every writer I know is good at telling stories orally. Maybe they don't like to do it in front of an audience, but it's fun. I just find it exciting. There's a certain amount of adrenaline. I find it hard to control my adrenaline when I'm writing. When I'm making a speech, I can walk around on the stage and I can open the floor to questions, and I mean, I can just sort of keep using the audience and the situation to keep myself up. But writing, you write something and then you can't think of anything else to write. And so you get up and you try to, and like my narrator, Guy Fox, in this novel, I have taken to chewing tobacco while writing. It's a habit I'm trying. I used to cover sports a lot. I would hang around with ball players and I started chewing a little tobacco every now and then. And I found it useful. I mean, it helped me to write, to have something in my mouth. I think there's something, you know, there's a kind of, writing is a kind of oral substitute, you know, and so my mouth feels frustrated. And I never have smoked. I used to smoke a pipe or a cigar while I wrote, but that was not good for me. At any rate, I'm always trying to run around looking things up in the dictionary, and the phone rings, and it's just a extremely raggedy process for me writing. It doesn't flow at all. It just sort of goes along in hitches and jerks. But and you get interrupted. If you're making a speech, you're not going to have to take a phone call in the middle of it. But if you're writing, the phone rings, or if I'm working in the country, the dog wants to get in, you know. I mean, I suppose I could set it up so that nothing can interrupt me, but on the one hand, I feel frustrated by being interrupted while I'm writing. On the other hand, I keep waiting for something to interrupt me while I'm writing. So, in other words, I'm just completely crazy while writing.
Well, I was reading some of the biographical data that Ballard sent over. It said that you have, your nonfiction work has been published in something like 90 publications?
That's right. That's not counting reprints. I think it's up to 94 now. 94 different magazines or newspapers. There are 94 different ones that I have written, you know, for, and have had things published in.
Some of them are rather obscure.
Yeah, there's, well, I had some poems in Organic Gardening. I don't know, it's amazing how many magazines there are. I had something recently in a magazine called, I forgot what it was. I think I had something published recently in a magazine called PC Computing. I've yet to find it on the newsstands, but they paid me, so I guess they published it. That's how I've made a living mostly, is by writing for lots of different magazines. And
how do you do it? Do you query them and say, look, I've got this article? Or you...
Hardly. I have an arrangement with the Atlantic Monthly that any idea that I come up with myself, I go to them first. You know, but most of my magazine work now, and for the last, and has been for the last few years, a number of years, is instigated by magazines. I mean, they call me up and say, "Will you write a piece about women's underwear for us?" And if it rings a bell with me, as the topic of women's underwear did, I say yes. I mean, I've always got this, got things sort of hovering around in my head, and I'm trying to find a place for them.
There are not too many topics that have escaped you, actually.
No.
I have a number of your books of essays, and you cover an awful lot of ground.
I hope I haven't run out of ground to cover. I don't know.
Is it possible?
Yeah. I mean, I think writers burn out pretty early, you know, in many cases. Writers do their best work generally before they're my age. I mean, I'm 48, and I think that any writer's crazy not to worry a bit about losing his fastball. I mean,
well,
I think I've lost my fastball.
Well, I don't know. Wilfred Sheed, I was interviewing him a while back. He's a critic and novelist, and he has a theory. It's called the 20-year itch theory, and his theory is that every writer has 20 good years. It doesn't matter when he starts. I mean, you could start at 48, and then you have 20 years after the age of 48, and you do your most productive work. Or you could start early. After about 20 years, he theorizes that you become the grand old man, you know, a distinguished professional. You could look back at what you've done, and because you're no longer really productive. And I don't know how valid that theory is, but it goes even further. You can change jobs. I mean, this could apply to anything. I mean, you could have 20 good years as a plumber before you burn out, and then you change over to being a carpenter. Right. And then you can start off, and the clock starts ticking again.
Well, I hope that's the case, because I was a sports writer for about 10 years, and then I guess I've been a humorist for about...
So you have 20 more years ahead as a novelist.
As a novelist. I can start all over, and after that I can be an epic poet or something.
Yeah. You have some ideas along those lines? Something about Vikings, maybe?
Maybe I'll write an epic poem about the federal deficit. The savings and loan crisis.
Well, Roy Blunt, this is a very funny book. The first hubby, delighted to see you again, and I wish you the best of luck with both the book and have fun on the tour.
Thank you, Don.
Hang on a second.